As I am presiding over the election of the acting justice, as carried by a rule of the night of the evening rules, may I speak as a nomination for the acting justice? Olga Putin.
I'm allowed to vote.
Do you have any other nomination? In the absence of any nomination, Dr. Khadi will confirm the acting chair. Thank you.
Honorable members of the committee, our guests from ICT and the public, the officials from the department, I officially welcome you in this meeting of the GD. As the Secretary of the Committee has indicated that the Chairman has sent an apology to go to West Parliament in Victoria. I think it's good because the women's rights are women's rights. And the issue of women empowerment cannot only be dealt with by women. Every member of the society must participate in that. Because if you are going to raise the tax back, the men themselves must take the lead. That's why I really appreciated the speaker, who has invited, in particular, the men, chairpersons of the Baras Committee, that they must be part of that men's parliament. So I do really appreciate the chairperson that he availed himself for that gathering. And then, as I said, that we welcome you. I say any apologies.
Thank you, Chair. I have two apologies, one from Honorable Kenneth and the other one from Honorable Mr. Thank you.
What is
the Honorable Kenneth attending the Women's Parliament and Honorable Mr. Thank you. Attending other meetings.
All right. Noted.
The apology I'm going to send the card and deliver it with the chief for a little company.
And then the next item on the agenda is the adoption of the agenda. We've got three agenda items. The first one is the quarterly report of the IRF. And the second one is the briefing of the impact of funds out of that foreign policy regarding the proceedings of Africa EPA. And then after that, we are going to have the IGP presenting the review of the South African relations between South Africa and the United Kingdom, in particular with the view of the impact of South African Brexit. So those are the agenda items. Is there anyone going to propose for adoption of the agenda or any other item?
I just would like to comment on the agenda. If I look at item 7, it's now going after lunch. Going into... on a Wednesday, because it's Christian Day, and it starts at 3 o'clock, committee meetings are supposed to end by 1, and then we have our own party bunch of duties and meetings and things like that. We utilize that time maybe for study groups or other meetings or other interactions. So I would just like to say that in future, maybe have proper information about the timing of these things, because I can see that the afternoon one may infringe on our afternoon activity. And I'm just saying, give us the courtesy of informing us, because I know we have a work meeting going on, we have other parts of the meeting.
Thank you, Honorable President. Honorable
Mukhala. Thank you very much, sir. I'm not supporting the agenda. I'm supporting what my colleagues are saying. And just to come up with a solution. I think let's see how far we go. Because of the ARF, we from last week, and then we can see how far we can go. And also as well as the EU-SADC partnership, I think the representative from IGD is here. So if we don't have to wait for him, he's already here. But I think really by then, we have already had him present. But let's see how the program goes.
Thank you for those opinions, I think the issue is how long to go to take for the name of the person. Then I think like the issue of whether we know which one is the woman's caucus even after the chief is named. I think that issue should work for the state of the Aboriginal Secretary. All right, on the... thank you. So the agenda is helping advocate. And then back to my ask myself, why did you propose it to the legislation from the department? Item 5 and 7. Next month we are going to have the Foreign Affairs Committee of the EU coming to the country. EU. They are coming to the country assisting us, and the Control Committee of Trade and Industry are going to engage the various stakeholders. So it was critical that we ourselves are briefed by the officials of our department so that as we move forward, we know that we are going to take proper policies as we engage with them. Also, the committee from the side of the UK will also be coming next month. So I think that this agenda is great to prepare for that, so that as they give us this information, we go into our own research, so that by the time they come on the third week of September, we are well prepared as the police, as the committee. Then we'd like to welcome those people who have been making presentations. On the side of the department, I'll hand over to the Deputy Minister, introduce the delegation, and then we must fire on directly on the issue of the ARF. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable
Mukhala.
Thank you,
Honorable
Mukhala. Good morning, my apologies. I get very suspicious when I see things like this. Chairperson, thank you for having us before the portfolio committee. I have with me Chairperson. Deputy Director General Jolie Fire. She is responsible for the Americas and Europe. And she will be making the presentation on Brexit. Next to me I have your old friend, Acting DG Mahai. Next to DG Maya is Mayor Tengu. She was here last week. Next to Mayor Tengu is Wu. She was also here last week. And next to her is Eric Sema. Next to Eric is Zaya Amin, my head of staff. The gentleman right on the end, Mr. Farmiel. He's also on the Europe desk of the So, Chair, you've asked us, firstly, in terms of the agenda, to make a presentation on ARF. So I'm going to ask Nebengu to proceed with that, with your permission.
Thank you, PM, and good morning to the honourable members. I'll take today the ARF as prevalent information as well as the financial information. We'll go straight to slide number 2. Where we are looking at the indicators for the fourth quarter. For this fourth quarter, what have we planned to do for the ARF is to respond to requests that have been received in terms of quality assurance and review of project proposals what we have done, because in this one quarter there were no projects that were pleased for us to do the quality review or to do the quality assurance and the review of the project. You will notice, Honourable Member, that or you will remember that this fund is only it only works on the request. So if there are no requests, there will be no project proposal. In the fourth quarter, there were no new project requests. So the other thing that was expected of this fund to do in the fourth quarter is for the advisory committee to have the meeting and review as well what the affairs of the fund. One scheduled meeting did took place and was held on the 23rd of February 2016. Which was the 63rd meeting of this advisory committee. Now, the coming or the next objectives or indicators that I will take you through are part of the objective of this fund. One of them is the democracy and good governance, where we support the democracy and good governance in terms of the projects that we have. We had two requests received in terms of disbursement of the fund in relation to democracy and good governance. And in that, those projects were in the election of the commission in Tanzania and also in Faisal, as indicated there on the slide number 2. When we move over to slide number 3, the next indicator is socio-economic development. In terms of this socio-economic development, there were also two requests that were received for us to disburse funds in relation to socio-economic development, and those two projects were the rice and vegetable projects, which are currently running, as well as the Cuban Medical Brigade in Sierra Leone. So those are the two around socio-economic development. In terms of the humanitarian assistance, we also received one request to process or to disperse funds to, which was the drought relief project in Namibia that we have done. In terms of the capacity building, there were two requests that were received by the department, the fund, to disperse the funds to, which were the African Capacity Building Foundation in Zimbabwe and also the Cuban Economic Package that we have done. The Cuban Economic Package is still going on, but the African Capacity Foundation was the final trend that we were doing in the fourth quarter. If we move over to slide number 4, Chairperson, that concludes the performance information for this fund, which we plan to do in the fourth quarter. So if you look at now slide number 4, it talks to the financial position of this fund. Currently, what we are sitting at when we opened the month of January, we were sitting at 2.3 billion. And of that, we received the interest of about 40 million. And then we have receivables amounting to about 210 million. And then we have funds that are committed already for the existing project. As you know, this fund has multi-year projects. So those multi-year projects are worth 987 million. And what we have disbursed in the fourth quarter alone, we are sitting at about 89 million, which are all those ones, the funds I've just spoken to earlier on. Now, what we are sitting at, or what we closed with at the end of March 2016, we were sitting at 1.5 billion in terms of the funds that can still be utilized by the fund from April up to end of March. Now, in terms of 2015-16, slide number 5, we just highlighted to the honorable members, just to remind, these are the projects that were approved in the year 15-16. The first one, it was technical support of the third general election of Burundi, which was 38 million, which was subsequently rescinded. And then we have Timbuktu manuscript, which was sitting at 7.2 million. We also approved Cuban Medical Brigade in Sierra Leone, of about 3.9 million. We also approved transportation of humanitarian assistance to Madagascar of about 195,000. We also approved African Capacity Building Foundation of about 2.3 million. And we also approved Cuban Economic Package of about 110 million. Chairperson and honorable members, in conclusion, I would like to indicate that the fund, in terms of the audit report, the fund has received unqualified conclusion on performance information, and they received unqualified audit opinion on financial statements. Thank you very much, honorable members.
Thank you, the FCCO, for the increased reward you have provided. It's very straightforward. And then this is a public amount of engagement. But I don't know, because when you look at page 2, Democrats and Governors, you spend only 23,000 for Seychelles and Tanzania. 23,000 a year.
Honorable Chair, it is 23,000 because it's been paid on monthly basis, on quarterly basis in tranches for as and when we dispense the report. So for that particular quarter, that was the only amount that was dispensed.
Thank you for the time. Honorable Chair, the report is in front of you. The right to engage with it and provide robust oversight over the area. Are there any takers? Let's take up.
Thank you very much, Chair. We know their report. I'm glad to see that the project that has been, I just want to find out the status of the other project. I know the Burundi one has been extended, but the other one, what is their status with the funds? And as we know, Chair, we always had an issue in about following the money of the DRS and to see the tangible projects that have been finished. And I think it has been prudent. I know for the purpose of this meeting we have to look at the snapshot report, but for the purpose of, I think maybe the annual report we might have a detailed one that shows the value, return on investment that we have made on this project. And the issue, just one question on the issue of the quality assurance. The FCCO has said they haven't done any quality assurance. I think, can you just elaborate on that? Because of, it will be quite a serious issue if there are projects and there are things that need to happen and the QAM is not done on the project. But what is the reason for that? The final one is the rescinding of this when is it being wooded up and for making way for that. Thank you,
sir.
Oh, thank you very much, sir. Really let me welcome the report. But I think Honorable Mukhalapa was already in my mind.
Oh,
yeah, so, in fact, my main issue was on the issue of the in the most was covered by the
other thank you. Any other speaker? There's no last question, not the same. Remember that was there for time. It's a flood was not
no, I think where trust is due, we must really have to do that. Especially receiving the unqualified, you know, because I think it needs to be recommended. And really, I think it would be really not right on our side really to get that claim. Zabonga, but Honorable Mukhalapa, I think you're not going to be a false prophet because you say that you can read people's minds. So, never. I hope you're not going to be a false
prophet. Thank you. I prefer to recall them.
Don't go there. Alright, so to that said, I also have our three questions to the presenter in particular. On the ecosystems, I forget with my colleagues, the issue of SARPA. It was really an annual performance by ATP of the three companies again. And you did see the last quarter. So, what is the progress? What is the progress, though? Because really, sometimes we might not get a qualified audit, but when you do look at the delivery on the ground, it might be different. Yeah? Because we're dealing with the lives of the people here. To ask what matters most is what difference we make on the ground, on the people on the ground. So the issue of the migration from ARF to South Africa is part
AMF. How far is it? I think I have presented the report on that part. I really appreciate it. And then when you go to page 3, there's 2 million liters of food for capacity building. African Capacity Building Foundation. Where is that foundation? For the first time, where is it? What is it taking? What is it doing? What is it doing? I think that we must get an explanation for that. And also really appreciate the issue of the transition stage for the Cuba economic and the package. Because that one was long overdue. Actually, it stressed us big time. Because the people were in need. The people had already put that money into their budget. Pressure. Could not be delivered by South Africa on time. Really, I really appreciate it now that that commitment was made and then we are executing it. I can see that they are still ongoing. You must focus report. How far it has gone? What is the benefit for the country and for the Cuban people? Those would be my three questions. Thank you. Over to you, Chief.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I will answer a few and then I will request the acting visitor to help me with the other ones. I will answer the easy one. Starting with the quality assurance. Honourable Chair, what we meant here, what happens is that when the AMS secretariat receives projects, they then quality assure them before they even go, the project proposals, we quality assure project proposals before they go to the advisory committee for presentation. That is the quality assurance that we're talking about here. So for as long as there is no project proposal received by the ARS secretariat, meaning that there won't be any quality assurance done on those project proposals. I'm not sure if that is clear. But on the projects that are on the ground, the quality assurance is done as and when the reporting is required. On the issue of the status of the project, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, when you look at the page 5, in terms of the first project, page 5 of the slide, in terms of the first project, which is the general election of Burundi, that one, as I said, that one is independent. And then the Timbuktu manuscript, that one has been put on hold due to security issues in Mali. And then the Cuban Medical Brigade in Sierra Leone, that one has been closed, it's finalized. And then the humanitarian assistance to Madagascar, that one is still ongoing. And then African Capacity Building, that one has also been closed. I'll explain what is this African Capacity Building later on. And then the Cuban economic package is in progress. It has started, but it's in progress, which we are planning to finish it by during the course of the next year or two. Yeah. Now the issue of the African Capacity Foundation, Honourable Chair, the African Capacity Foundation is based in Zimbabwe, and this is they are training a government institution on governance. And this is a project that is led by the national or the independent from the South African side is National Treasury. They are the project owners on this one. I think I have covered then the cyber. I will hand over to the acting.
Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, regarding transition to SAPA, we too experience problems. SAPA has been proclaimed as a government component in 2013 to be precise. However, to be operationalized on the fund, there needs to be a legislative, and the current ARS Act needs to be repealed. The bill has been in the pipeline and has not moved outside of the cabinet process because there was an impasse, I call it, in which Treasury is believing that it should have concurrent on the fund in the same way as the ARF. Yet this is to be an entity that should be squarely under the Department of International Relations. We could not strike any agreement after cabinet had reflected the bill there for us to agree. So as a result, the ARF will continue to exist in its form until this bill is processed and repeal it, in which case then SATPA will be able to administer the new partnership fund, which is where the new bill is called South African Partnership Development Fund Bill. So we are stuck, and maybe my boss, DM, will be able to elaborate further on the legislative part of it. Thank you.
That ADC was not achieved, and from the local thing, it's not going to be achieved in the near future. So it means that the IRS is here for quite a long time. What about you, DM?
Yeah, Chairperson, it's one of those instances where, as an experienced member of parliament in this institution, you will understand better than most. It's a question of accountability, firstly. So, between Treasury and DERCO, you have this deadlock around the question of whether the bill should read after consultation with Treasury or in consultation. Just to explain, for those who may not be aware of this, after consultation means that it does not need Treasury's approval or go ahead. It simply requires the departments to inform Treasury of a particular project, and it then proceeds to implement the funding for that project. Whereas in consultation requires Treasury and or the Minister of Finance to grant approval for the project to go ahead. That is where the matter is stuck. I have personally put in my hand, Chairperson, I personally said to everyone, listen, simply put both options and allow Cabinet to decide. Knowing full well, Chairperson, that bill, even when Cabinet decides, will come before this portfolio committee. And you will apply your considerable wisdom and decide what is the best option, not for ERCO, not for Treasury, but for the ultimate users of money that will come from that part. Mm-hmm. So that's where we stand, Chairperson.
All right. As our official engineer, it shows that there's some work which is being done, but I think that should not be easy. Because there was a concept why we need a startup, why we needed more accountability, because also the issue of accounting environment for the other part of the problem was old. So I think this is a help work. I think only the parliament can make a bridge that development. The sooner it comes, the better. Yeah. I think that part of our site work, we have to go and engage the department and engage the government. I'm not going to have these people are report very soon. Yeah. I think that we must invite the government and engage around that angle so that really the people are suffering on the ground. Because when we speak about the people of South Sudan, because unless the model of the fund changes, unless we can proactive. Because why do we have million applications when we know that the people, there's a camp of more than 200,000 people somewhere in South Sudan. Those people are hungry, they don't have water. Why do we have to wait for them to come when you can see for them? They don't have so much of Ubuntu. I think that we can elevate this thing so that we can perform better. I think that we must do that ourselves and engage both departments so that the thing can tell them and get and go forward.
If I could just appeal, Chairperson, again, given the Honourable Member's considerable experience in this matter, please hold accountability as an important criteria in considering this matter, okay? So that you don't find yourself in a situation down the road where money is actually being wasted unnecessarily.
I think that the discussion is people are speaking with a full child and arrest them. That's the bottom line. But remember, I don't think there's been any better pressure from the side of the public hearing. But I also confirm my colleagues that we really appreciate the work being done by the official state department and ARF in particular in ensuring that the funds are accounted for properly and then it's an unrequired audit. It's very, very important that we maintain that status. So without further ado, yes,
the issue of spoiling the money, are there any steps taken by the department?
The issue of spoiling the money, it means that we go and have
money there in the right project, who goes and evaluates that project to ensure that it is done, it is doing what it is supposed to do. Because the money was, even if Jonathan doesn't have a problem, because the money ended up in the pocket of the politician or on the feet of the politician somewhere. So what the candidate does is Department F is ensuring that the money invested in the barrage project and get valuable money for us. And then everybody from Palapa has said, I think that with this project, when coming to the issue of the annual report, you must come with a comprehensive report about each and every project. What is happening, how many people have benefited from that, what were the problems? So that as we go to the start, we are able to have a better lens of understanding about that. What is the question?
Honorable Chair, honorable members, we will bring the committee when it is the annual report on this later. I just wanted to give the AR Secretary an opportunity to comment on the given part of the
Thank you, Chairman.
Yes.
I'll respond to the issue of Cuba and what the benefits were for North Africa and what the benefits were for the Cuban people. So the Cuban economic package, there were three packages. It was divided into three packages. And the first package was to purchase seeds. So Cuba was going through difficulties with their agriculture, and we were helping to restart their agricultural produce. So we purchased seeds. All the seeds that were purchased were planted and have been harvested. And the second part of the package was to purchase from South African companies. So one of the South African companies was Sumitomo, where they purchased tires. And because of the package and because of the funding that South Africa provided, folks were to purchase tires from Sumitomo. So Sumitomo will be making a further investment in South Africa to now manufacture tires for tractors, which they did not produce in the past, but because of the demand from Cuba, they will now be producing that in South Africa. We'll need to address the issue of the National Development Plan of in creating employment. So we are still ongoing with the Cuban economic package, and they are purchasing from South African manufacturers, and the aim of that is to stimulate manufacturing and to create jobs in that particular sector. So to go on to the next question that was raised by the honourable member of how does ARF follow the money? I'll respond in particular to the project in Conakry. So how we run the project in Conakry is that the money is not given to the government of Conakry. The money is given on a monthly basis to our mission in Conakry, who has an office, the ARF office, that is specifically looking at running the particular project. So the nation runs an ARF office with staff that only run the ARF project in the country because it's an ongoing project and it's such a big project. So the government of Guinea, there is no money that is given to the government of Guinea directly. And what we also do as the ARF secretary, we go on the ground to evaluate the project. And the last time we were in Palakri, there were 4,500 farmers that have benefited from this project. And Guinea has not had a food shortage of rice ever since the project has started in that country. And we also get monthly financial reports and monthly reports on a regular basis of the particular funds that we transfer to the nation. And just to also give one last example, the transportation of the humanitarian assistance to Madagascar. So the goods that we have related to Madagascar have arrived in Madagascar, and the government has confirmed that the consignment has arrived, and we will go on the ground in Madagascar to ensure that the goods are distributed to the intended recipients. Thank you, Professor.
Well said. The diplomat of Ubuntu Educator.
Maybe I was disagreeing about something. I didn't hear the answer to your question as to why can't we go take initiative and go to a place like Southland and assist without building one. I didn't hear that.
I was raising the comment that the sooner we might get from ARF to start, then we can have proactive funding. Because the model which is used now by ARF does not allow that.
Okay.
So that's why the people are asking who is that project of Guinea-Conakry.
is going to ensure food and drink in that country. It's a plan for us. That package of sugar, the seed was bought from us, and then we are stimulating our own economy. At the same time, we are helping other people. Mm-hmm. I think we could, I feel that the type of foreign relations we must have as a country. We really appreciate the work you have done. Let's do better. We can never say that we are satisfied, but we can do better. But good. The results are good. Can we go to the next presentation, please, so that we can make our time successful? We're going to do the next presentation. Masala Maya, DDC Maya or?
Ambassador.
But I can just open the meeting. We are really welcome to this opportunity to share our thoughts and observations on this Brexit process of this move. It's of particular importance to us. In fact, it's of particular importance to us because the EU is the biggest trading bloc for South Africa. And also the UK is one of our biggest trade and investment partners. It stands at number 8, it's the 8th biggest trade partner for South Africa at the moment. I know that my principal always asks me, are you sure 8 after which countries? But we come to that question when the time comes. At the moment, we are only dealing with speculation and assumptions. No one really knows what the final outcome is going to be. And I am forces you with my team that we only have a fair idea towards the end of the 2-year period that will really result in the exit. Because at the moment, the UK is still very much attached to the EU as a bloc. With those few comments, Chair, I would like to hand over to Ambassador Fermulen to do the presentation and we'll handle all the questions that may come to that.
Thank you very much, DDG. Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, Deputy Minister, Acting DDG, my fellow colleagues, thank you for this opportunity. This is our presentation on Brexit. On the 23rd of June this year, 52% of the UK electorate voted in favour of the withdrawal from the EU Brexit. The outcome was a big surprise. I think even the EU, even in the UK itself, it came as a surprise, despite the fact that the opinion polls before the referendum indicated that it was on a nice edge. It is a major development, though it's far-reaching global implications, not only for the EU, not only for the EU members, but for the UK. The fact is that the UK joined the EU in 1973, and it is the first state to withdraw in its 58 years of existence. Now, when we looked at the reasons why the referendum went the way it went, we came up with the following reasons. What influenced the outcome? It says that small on the screen. Yeah. Shall I continue a little bit?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So the outcome of the referendum was influenced by the following factors. The Euroscepticism, heightened by the ongoing migration crisis now in Europe, the perception that increased migration leads to decreased employment opportunities for UK citizens. Also, the poor economic performance in Europe that has still not recovered after 2008. There is also growing resistance to the role of Brussels, leader of course the EU, and its impact on the United Kingdom's own sovereignty. Then there was also, and this is a very specific influence, the discontent of the older blue-collar establishment in the UK, and many of them actually felt that they had lost their jobs or lost income because of the migration influx into the UK. Many younger voters did not participate in the referendum, and many analysts believe that their participation would have favored the Remain vote. There was a very clear generational difference in the way in which the voters actually voted. There's also a perceived democratic deficit in which the citizens feel that they do not have an impact on the decision-making processes of the EU. Then the last one is something interesting. We actually asked the EU mission in Pretoria to give us a briefing on their type of what happened to the referendum. And they indicated to us that they very much regret that they did not actually try to communicate the benefits of the EU for UK for UK citizens in the run-up to the referendum. If you look at the implications of Brexit for the United Kingdom, firstly, politically, I think we've all seen that the political fallout to the referendum was very quick. Prime Minister Cameron, immediately after the referendum, indicated that he would like to, that he was going to step down. He actually set the target date of October, by which time they wanted the new Prime Minister and the Cabinet to be in office. But after a very intense campaign in the Conservative Party, Theresa May, the former Home Secretary, won the conference of the party members, and she was sworn in as Prime Minister on the 13th of July, 2016. She herself is a year of skeptic, but she has indicated directly afterwards that, in her own words, Brexit means Brexit, that the government will honour the outcome of the referendum. But in the negotiations with the EU, she also indicated that she wanted the closest possible economic ties with the EU. On the other hand, the Labour Party, the opposition party, Mr. Jeremy Corbyn, he survived a vote of no confidence in his leadership, sparked by very low profile during the main campaign, and in his party many felt he should have done more to lobby in favour of the Remain vote. He still now faces a very strong internal challenge, and it is, in our view, it is unlikely that he will survive very much longer. Meanwhile, what is also crystallized in the Labour Party is they have indicated that they will consider a second referendum if they came to power. The Liberal Democrat, Lib Dems of Mr. Nick Clegg, has also now, I think, they've been re-energized by the referendum outcome. And they've already said that they will fight the next election on a promise to take the UK back into the EU. So I think the political dynamics in the UK is going to be very interesting to follow and how this is going to play out. Meanwhile, of course, if one looks at the referendum outcome, in Scotland, 62% of electorate voted to remain within the EU, and in Northern Ireland it was close to 56%. And the UK government will now have to deal with the dissatisfaction in Scotland and Northern Ireland. This dissatisfaction could feed into renewed calls for the independence of Scotland. You'll recall that in 2014 there was a referendum on independence in which 55% of the electorate actually voted to remain in the UK. But the First Minister of Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon, she already indicated that they will certainly look at calling perhaps a second independence referendum in Scotland. There will also be calls for a review of the ties between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, and these are all internal political issues that the UK government will have to look at. If we look at the economic implications on the UK, the pound immediately reached a record low after the referendum, coupled with the decline in the London Stock Exchange. That was the immediate reaction. Meanwhile, I think we've all seen that that the pound has strengthened. But even so, international credit rating agencies have also cut the UK's credit rating. It must be said, it's not that they downgraded to less than junk status. They were in a very high category. And it's a symbolic downgrading, indicating lack of confidence or loss of confidence in the UK economy. There is also in the UK a cut with interest rate from 0.5% to 0.25%, taking it to its lowest level since 2009. The UK's Treasury has stated that the economy could contract between 3 and 6% in the 2 years after Brexit. That's after Brexit, it's not now already. The Bank of England predicts lower growth over the next 2 years, even before Brexit takes place, as well as an increase in inflation linked to the weakening pound. Looking at the task at hand for the UK, what we found when we looked at this is that the UK's exit agreement, well, depending on the exit agreement with the UK, will have to withdraw from more than 5,000 EU regulations, as well as 1,100 trade agreements signed with third countries, including with South Africa. So the continued uncertainty caused by Brexit is expected to continue impacting negatively on the UK economy. There will be fluctuations, but the general trend is expected to be downward. If we look at the trade and development impact of Brexit for the EU, it is worthwhile noting that the UK is the second biggest EU trade partner after Germany. It accounts for 13% of the EU's internal trade and 15% of the imports to and from non-member countries. Now also when we look at development assistance, the EU is still provides one of the largest inroads of development assistance in the international community in fact. And if you look at development in the EU, the UK is the largest contributor, representing 15% of the European Development Fund. So the UK's absence from negotiations in the next EU budget and its priorities post-2020 will have a direct and long-term implication on the impact of EU official development assistance policies. This is what we expect. Now also, due to the UK being the United States' largest single market in the EU, the Brexit may negatively affect the finalization of the UK's EU mega trade agreement. I don't know what this thing is really called, but I'm sure that you've noticed also that there appears to be a revision in this.
TTIP.
I read just this morning, in fact, that France indicated that they will ask for a TTIP to continue at this point. Now, the level of integration. Brexit could have a twofold effect on European integration. You'll recall that in the past, the UK has resisted and slowed down the whole concept of moving to an ever closer union. With the EU now, with the UK out of the equation, that move might grow stronger. But at the same time, Brexit may also have or serve as motivation for nationalists, nationalistic and Eurosceptic sentiment across the EU countries. Called for similar referendums. We've already seen immediately afterwards in France, maybe independence asked for something like that. And it's not only in France, it's across the EU where right-wing parties appear to be gaining ground. Now let's look at the Brexit implications for South Africa. And DDG, already you mentioned in your introduction the importance of the strategic relationship that South Africa enjoys with the UK. We thought that we should actually have a look at just where we stand in terms of trade, tourism and all of that, just to give you an indication of the importance of the relationship with the UK. The UK is a single country, is South Africa's sixth largest bilateral trading partner, DDG, you mentioned that. And if you look at the statistics for 2015, this is last year, South Africa's exports to the UK amounted to 41 billion rand. We indicated there what are the main drivers, it's platinum products, commercial and passenger cars, and then also in the agro-processing sector, where wine, citrus, deciduous fruits each represent 4% of South Africa's exports to the UK. The imports from the UK last year amounted to 35 billion, which gave South Africa a balance of 6.6 billion, and there are not many countries in Europe with which South Africa, of course, enjoys a trade benefit surplus. If you look at the investment picture, it looks even, I don't know how to put it, but the UK is the country with the single most investment in South Africa. In 2000, the year 2000, the UK's investment in South Africa amounts to 45% of the total. Now, even though it has been declining since then because of the rise, especially of imports and investments from Asia, in 2014, the UK accounted for 50% of direct inward investment and 42% of all portfolio investment in South Africa. These figures we received from the Treasury.
Okay, guys. I think that the problem is the presentation which we have, which we receive
from
what we don't have those slides. So we really appreciate that these those slides can be made available so that the members can interact with us. Thank you. Although it's going to be a disadvantage because we have engaged with us before we came here and then did some mini research around those issues. But what we're presenting is not the same today, but okay, one of the members are really appealing that we focus on that, but not in our presentation.
Thank you, Honourable. Okay, thank you, Honourable Chair. But we've updated this, and I think something went wrong just with the communication. We think it's through yesterday that there was not sufficient time to circulate to portfolio committee members. But if I then can continue, if you look at the tourism figures, the UK is still the largest number of one source of overseas tourists. Not overall, if you look at countries, other countries in Africa, they have a higher total. But from overseas countries, more than 4,000 visitors from the UK last year. 400,000. Then if you look at visa requirements, because the question I've been raising, we thought we should actually mention the visa regime between South Africa and the UK. Your report, the UK unilaterally introduced visa requirements on all passport holders, South African passport holders, and this is something that we immediately resisted the government. We immediately asked the UK to review that. And the first indications that they were actually doing that, frustration built up. So that when there was no movement in September 2014, we introduced to South Africa visa requirements for UK diplomatic passport holders to send a message. They responded almost immediately, didn't you, or all. But it's been visa requirements, but only for South African diplomatic passport holders. So they want to take the doctor a step where they want to negotiate first official, but the approach of retaking is no. We want to negotiate once abolishment of visa requirements for all passport holders. We don't want to do a piecemeal. If you look at the implications of Brexit for South Africa, what will govern South Africa's trade relations with the EU in the future? And the answer we come up with is that the EU's common international trade policy, which is currently in existence, will continue to apply to South Africa's trade relations with the UK during the UK's 3-year withdrawal period from the EU, and while the EU is still a member of the EU. But the UK will cease to be a party once elected to the SADC-ECWA, which was signed on 10 June this year, and the target date to be ratified is in October this year. This, of course, provides increased market access into the EU for South African products, but this will not apply to South African products to the UK in the future. In preparation for the eventual Brexit, it will be necessary, therefore, to enter into discussions with the UK on future trade relations, and probably it will require a new bilateral trade agreement. Questions are also asked about the investment protection regime for the UK, and what DPI is saying is that the Act on Investment Promotion and Protection will cover investments from the UK, and it will not be required to negotiate any special or new instrument just for the UK. Further, if you look at the implications on South Africa-EU relations, and this is the important point to make, there will be no change in the framework of South African-EU relations as a result of Brexit. We will continue with the instruments we have, and this is specifically the TCA. There's the bilateral agreement with the EU on trade development cooperation, as well as the EPA. If you look at the importance of the EU as a trading and investment partner of South Africa, as a bloc of 28 members, they are still the largest trading partner and largest foreign investor. The imports from the EU totaled 320 billion rand in 2015. Exports 216 billion, which of course leaves a deficit of 104 billion. It's important to note the investments of the EU in South Africa. More than 2,000 EU companies operate within South Africa, creating an estimated 350,000 jobs. And if you look at the investment of FDI stock, 77% comes from the EU. If we look now the way forward for the United Kingdom, people ask us what is going to happen now. The procedure to withdraw membership from the EU is based on Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, which states that member states who wish to leave the Union must first negotiate the terms of their exit. This process takes up to 2 years, and is triggered only once a country leaving invokes Article 50. I'm sure that you have noted that within individual EU countries, and from the leadership within the EU, there's a lot of pressure on the UK to expedite the process. But Theresa May, significantly, directly after she took office, her first visits were to Germany and to France. And she used those occasions to say that the UK is not going to be pushed into this, that they need to do their analysis and preparations. And she also said that it will probably not take place the triggering of Article 50 before the next year. Well, she indicated it will certainly not take place this year. Now, what happens if no agreement is reached within the 2 years after the country leaving the sphere of the thing? It means that if after 2 years there can't reach agreement, then exit is automatic. Ukraine will be out. But there's an option also for both parties, when as they negotiate, to agree to extend the two-year negotiating period. This is another option. Prime Minister May has meanwhile appointed prominent EU and Remain campaigners in the new cabinet. Importantly, Boris Johnson, we all know the former London mayor, who was a very strong pro-EU voice, was appointed as the foreign secretary. Mr. Davis, also a strong EU campaigner, was put in charge of the new Brexit ministry. They're creating a completely new ministry to negotiate, to handle the Brexit. And then Mr. Liam Fox, also a strong EU campaigner, has been appointed as internal trade secretary. Philip Hammond, who was the previous secretary for the foreign secretary, he was appointed to the very important powerful chancellor of the exchequer. It's been the holiday season, of course, in Europe, and I'm sure that you've seen that Prime Minister May has called for this week. She wanted the think scrum of the whole cabinet to focus exclusively on the Brexit issue and where they can discuss strategy. In the interim, and this is a very important point, while the EU has not exited the EU yet, the UK has not exited the UK, until such time as the UK has exited the EU, it will continue to be a full EU member, bound by lost rules and treaties. Having said that, already they are not as intensely involved in the EU matters as in the past. In terms of the rotational system that they have, the UK was supposed to take over the presidency in the latter of this last 6 months of 2017, next year. And the EU has already said that they will not take that up. People also ask us, what's the way forward for South Africa? What is the way forward for South Africa? The fact is that this is what we wanted to say right from the beginning, and TVG Maya also indicated that much uncertainty around Brexit remains. It is therefore very important that we should continue monitoring the development. And perhaps something to look out for now that things will start rolling is UK's approach negotiating strategy with regard to the Brexit, and we also know what to do ourselves. It is proposed that South Africa should engage the UK's political leadership to ensure that the SA-UK strategic bilateral relationship continues seamlessly after Brexit. As officials, we have already recommended that with the G20 coming up and with UNRWA 71 coming up in the next month, that our principals, our president and our minister should consider perhaps requesting bilateral agreements with its new counterparts from the UK. South Africa should meanwhile also position itself as a priority country and start negotiating market access to South African products and services as soon as possible. The UK High Commissioner came to see us, she indicated, CDG will recall, that South Africa, other Commonwealth countries certainly offer regarded as priority countries for South Africa. But even though if one considers how many trade negotiations, trade deals the UK will have to negotiate in the future, we cannot take this for granted. And we will have to start early and we'll have to keep knocking on the door of the UK. While these are early days, South Africa should also seek out possible opportunities that Brexit may present for Africa, BRICS and other formations. People ask that. What are the impacts of Brexit on Africa and BRICS? And really, it's too early to tell. On BRICS, just keep in mind that the BRICS itself as a formation does not have any formal relationship with the UK, so they deal with their relations, the BRICS countries, on a bilateral basis. So Africa should also, of course, continue monitoring the impact of Brexit on the financial markets and capital flows and take necessary action to ensure stability. Thank you, Chair. With that, this is the end of the presentation.
Chair.
All right. Thank you, Ambassador.
Just one little amendment, please, with your permission, if I may. Ambassador Vermeulen and says Britain unilaterally introduced visa requirements on South Africans. Well, in fairness to Britain, the truth of the matter, and we all recall this, someone who had fraudulent identity documents issued from South Africa was found in Britain. And that is what triggered the requirement for visas by South African passport holders. It was not a unilateral decision. And what they did was impose a very stringent fee, visa fee, of 10,000 rand. Not everyone can afford 10,000 rand. So in fairness to you and to the British, I didn't like it. We all screamed and said, let's reciprocate, ban all Britons from coming here and so on. But the truth of the matter is, that's why they did it. And since then, we have tightened up and strengthened our systems so that our identity documents are properly issued. Thank you, Chair. By the way, you recall that yesterday, National Assembly ratified the SADC EPA.
Thank you from the side of EPA. Here's the presentation from the department. I think that if I highlight the issues which we always bother at the TC, but also, you know, we have to reflect. We came for a special relationship with them. Because of the historic place, whatever happens there affects our citizens right here in the country. That's why it is by no surprise other than Calabar that they invest so much in this country, because they knew that they were here for many years. And it is critical that the department ensures that those relationships are well cultivated and strengthened so that we don't lose at the end of the day. But I feel that if we do the forum of the Commonwealth, I think that this must be taken there and engaged with the UK, so that comes with a common approach. Although, when we are with the EU, it also has implications for us as a country. If the UK was the biggest donor of official development and support for the EU, it means that all the other projects across the continent are also going to be affected. That's why I really, really appreciate that the Department of Sport Action engaged with the High Commission of the UK so that we can put this thing out. Man. Because we really need them, they need us, we really need them, so that moving forward, we go as a solid team because of our expertise. Eh? But this is not for me, this is for the entire TC members. If there are any takers, let's take us in this presentation. Honorable Marila, Honorable Kalyan, Honorable Tashman, in that one. And then Honorable Mukalaba and then Honorable Mumma, Rafuti.
Attention.
Is there a practical point for this stage judicial meeting so that we can engage with that people? Because really, I think that I will not ever agree to the person to act for him if I'm going to get such a presentation. I think it is very bad. It does not reflect well for the committee. Yeah, it does not reflect well for the committee. Between the department and the school, we have the PLO from the side of the ministry. You also have the secretary. You cannot have the distinction. If you have said yesterday, definitely have been arrested and brought this into our attention. Okay. So can someone please go and produce those things which are outstanding? So can someone go and get those changes, please? So that because we're going to have another presentation from the IGT. Those changes are going to help us in engaging the IGT. Yeah, which is we need. Really, I think what must happen is, we have to deal with this. This must never happen. It's bad, but it must never happen again. I think this is wrong. It is wrong, we don't have that accountability of that nation. Because it is something we've been hidden away from us.
Yeah.
And then, I think the ethos of our country and our government. All right, but in the meantime, I've spoken to you, Honorable Maida, Honorable Kaya, and Honorable Gassman, and Honorable Mukhalaka, and then Raku.
Thank you very much, sir. And maybe let me start by welcoming the presentation. That's the one thing, because again, these things are equally preparedness for the future. But I just the one question. Don't we envisage somewhere in the future where we'll be put maybe against the wall and be forced to choose either between the EU and the United Kingdom? That's not my question. No, I'm not asking you.
Thank you, Honorable Maida. Honorable Kalyan?
Yeah, thank you. I'm just interested to know what the seven countries before us is. You said it has come up and I was waiting patiently. But I just need to know, for example, let's look at the South African situation. If we decide to pull out of the AU, what would the implications be? Would it be the same as the UK's exit from the EU? I'm trying to see if there is a parallel on it, because there is some discontent, I think, in Africa with the original mandate of the AU and what it's currently doing. Although the AU doesn't have the same powers as the EU, remember that the Pan-African and Parliament was formed on the basis of being the EU equivalent of Africa. And if there is any kind of thinking along that line, it would be nice to hear about it.
Alright, just before I give Oliver Brockman, the East African countries is in priority, but I think that's one of the AU, South Africa, the withdrawal from the AU. It might be the DDC which is in Africa. You can look at that. But if you can tell us what, if we have that capacity.
Sure.
Yeah. Another question.
Thanks, Chair. I'm interested more in the fact that we're in our control in trying to weather the Brexit storm. And I think it's important that we look at those and we ourselves as a committee take the official heed of that. And I think one of the things in our control is political stability. And I think we've come out of an election where we've shown what a democracy can do and how we fit that interim chamber results, etc. Yeah. I think the political parties have done their bit, but now we're seeing our stars wars in that. And I think we need to find ways in which we can assist in creating that political stability. So the last thing we need, Brexit or Red Ripple, will be just a shadow of what the real consequences can be of political instability within our own borders. Now, we need our banks to remain strong and independent and uninfluenced, and I think that's been one of the saving graces of our of weathering a lot of the economical storms. And tourism is another one. You know, as I mentioned there in terms of visa requirements and what have you. We had a presentation from the DG, and he told us about the amount of each British tourist that comes here. Because of the pound, the exchange rate, the jobs that are created, the increasing growth that is created from tourism. Now, one of the suggestions he made was to increase the amount of trade shows that we host as a country. And I think this committee, again, should almost aggressively try to pursue international trade shows from within our shores to... And I'd say not to be put in a corner where we have to choose between EU and the UK. I think we really need to flirt with both very strongly. But I just believe that we can control whatever we can control. We should be trying to do as much of that as possible now. And then come the 2 year time, that will not even really be a concern because it will just be time ripple. If we can control the economy, everything else will go right.
Honourable Kanapa,
thank you very much, Chair. Let me also welcome the presentation. I think it helps us for the meeting ahead. I just got one thing, that is from the SADC regional point of view. And I think let me also bring the question that Honourable Chairman has brought about the EU. I think it applies the same with SADC. If the scenario, if we paint the same scenario that the UK has done to the EU, what happens is the same applies to us here in the SADC. But the most important question here is about the impact of the Brexit on the SADC economic partnership. What will it mean? I know that it will take 2 years for the UK to negotiate their exit. And in terms of the EU protocol, they got 10 months for when they will officially no longer be bound by any EU protocol. In an interim, what does this mean? Because of you to recall that the negotiation of the budget EU earmarks was based on the issue of bilateralism. The EU having the capacity to go bilateral to individual sided countries and negotiating, while we were pushing for a broader regional consensus negotiation. What then does this mean in terms of the UK exiting the EU? One day take the same approach of going bilateral and negotiating with the 14 member states of the SADC, while on the other hand we want to strengthen the SADC EU relations. What is the impact there in terms of the sustainability of the SADC EU earmarks with the UK entry? Because of then they will have the leverage and the leverage to go on their own and negotiate bilaterally and individually, while we've got this broader framework with the region and the EU. Thank you.
All right, thank you. One of the members, we have adopted an agenda which really reflects what we are going to discuss next, but certain things a little bit out. Take example, like the issue of the South World, which we cannot expect the department to respond to that. Actually, it's a clear indication of the vibrancy of our democracy that our state institutions are independent. They don't take that from anyone. That's part of our strength. That starts to take its decisions. The National Constituting Authority will take its decisions. How to take that decision? It is us. Let us not go with that terrain. I don't think that they're going to help us here. Let's see this thing. We can help or we can help, but not in this meeting here. And then, that our Dutch Secretary Department, I don't think can get into that thing.
I've been asking a lot of questions. You know, looking at the people who have influence in the voting processes of the British, which amounts to about 52% of the people in the UK. And I'm asking myself, who actually voted? No. And what was the rationale? Was it not actually a miscarriage? It's a miscarriage if abused on the other side. That, you know, people, you know, they have miscarried a good and a healthy thing. So those are my real, lot of questions that I'm asking about all that is actually what we're dealing with this issue of this thing. Whether it was this naive upcoming youth with the excitement or what?
The EFF?
Because those things we must bring them in and really, because people are, they can be influenced with excitement and not really not understanding without, you know, maturity. Because this thing is being, how many years, 58 years is of existence. But why now? I thank you.
I really appreciate the questions you asked here. And then, Honorable Apoja, I'm not answering anyone, but I think what is critical here, the Dragons have made their voice. They made their choice. We must respect it as the Republic of South Africa. We must deal with it, but we must ensure that it does not affect us negatively. Instead, we're forward. I don't want any comments. I don't have any question or comments about that. I have to put that to the department.
Just a few points, if I may, Chipperson, and then I'll hand over to Ambassador Vermeulen and DDG Meyer. We note the points made by most honourable members, The Honourable Kalyan raises an interesting scenario where the Republic of South Africa possibly withdraws from the AU. Now, Che, you will recall that the AU is the successor of the OAU, so it goes way back. And during that period, we had late Muammar Gaddafi floating the idea and the dream that he had of the United States of Africa. Mm. Now, we need to bear in mind that the strength of his union lies in the manner in which they conduct themselves, the benefits citizens of the member states derive from these unions. I think that's an important point. Because if the citizens of the member states don't see the benefits accruing to them, they'll start asking, why are we there? Now, without making this as a criticism, we are not a member of the EU, but this criticism was made by both British and other member states, that the EU tended to be very unilateral in its decision making, okay? And lack of accountability. You would have a person appointed by a senior EU minister, and he would take responsibility for a whole range of things and simply walk into a country and take decisions and implement things. And that person would not be accountable to the people of the member state. That's for Britain, that's a key issue. For them, that's a no-no. You've committed a cardinal sin. The Honourable Mr. Bergman moots the idea of hosting more trade shows. We note that and we'll take it with us. It should also be raised in the Trade Industry Portfolio Committee chair. I agree with him that it's not a case of choosing between the EU and Britain, which brings me to my next point, which is raised by the Honourable Mahanabu. Clearly, Chairperson, in the same way that the EU is presently engaging in negotiations with a whole host of people, including the third country, Britain too will have to do the same. Okay? Now, what the EU did was to negotiate with individual member states of SADC and then with SADC as a regional bloc. Hence, yesterday's ratification of the trade agreement, which we agreed to in the National Assembly. The important point here to bear in mind, Chairperson, in all these things, is our national interest. What is in South Africa's national interest? How are these things going to benefit us as a country and for the people on the ground, which you're constantly reminding us about? And so that is the main issue that we have to bear in mind at all times. TTIP, it looks like it's dead in the water. It's called the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. It's President Barack Obama's, he was hoping it would be his legacy. But when you read the fine print of TTIP, it's a monstrosity. Because effectively it says, you that sign this agreement with us, your laws on conservation, on consumerism, on everything, all of that, yes, they become subsumed to us, and they don't apply to us. So we can bring our goods into your country, and those laws don't apply to those goods. And that is why there have been enormous demonstrations, Chairperson, which our media, unfortunately, hasn't really carried it, but they have taken place in Europe, particularly in Germany. The German Minister of Economics has given his thumbs up in opposition to Angela Merkel, by the way, and, of course, as was pointed out by the French head of state, doing the same. So these are all the matters that one needs to bear in mind. So it's early days yet, and we agree with Honorable Bergman and yourself. There's going to be visits by British policymakers. I've been contacted by my counterpart from Britain. He's coming to South Africa and he's asked to see me, which I've agreed to. And there will be more of those. But again and again, whatever we do must be in our national interest. Thank you.
We would like to be cautious in our response to that. And especially because we understand the meeting. So we anticipate that this discussion is going to take place today, and we can then be able to share whatever outcome.
One question
we would like to go outside and contact here because we are
Chair, that's precisely why DDG Maya. Yes. Yeah, we don't want to. It may offend the member states.
Yeah.
And say you flipped us at 4 when actually we are 6 at 2.
Yeah.
Or something like that. So we want to. Please allow us. Yeah, you can Google. Yeah.
You know, I like the answer I received last week when I spoke about the company. We are telling you, we are extracting in
Western Sahara.
Western Sahara. Yeah. I like the answer you came to me. No, most of these websites, and then we take everything. They didn't come here. So I'm not a breakfast.
But we need to follow up on that share, all the same.
Yeah.
I can do that research myself.
Yeah, exactly. So it's okay because it's just not from the other thing. But is there any input on you so that you can come to the next thing?
Yes, that's very true. Again, the question that was asked as to who voted and whether we know whether why now was it in miscarriage, what motivated the vote for the outcome. We shared a few thoughts in our presentation, but the most critical part was the fact that according to this death, that are in the public domain, it's clear that young people did not vote. Mostly the older and the elderly. We mentioned the content of the older group conduct establishment in the UK. And unfortunately, some of the information that is coming through, that is coming through immediately after the vote, was that the farm, at the point when we were monitoring, the number was just climbing over the 1 million mark. Some British people were beginning to ask what the EU is, what it does for them, and what the implications would be if they were to leave. So that theory clearly shows that some of the ones who voted did not understand what they were doing. And also there is a very serious nationalistic sentiment that is creeping in. As the presentation shows, and that most of the sentiment is driven by the immigration flow in Europe. And some countries, even part of South Africa that we used to know as being supportive, being welcoming, are now becoming very insular and inward looking. And they believe that the immigrants that are flowing through their countries and some choosing to stay are eating into social benefits that could be going for them and their children. So, although our friends from Europe say to us, no, we are not xenophobic. We support them and say, no, it's only xenophobia when it's in Africa. When it's with you, it's nationalism, it's okay to love your country to the extent that you don't want anyone else to be part of what you are doing. So, those are just some of the thoughts that we have been sharing with our UK friends and partners and others, not just from Europe, but also from, surprisingly, the Americans. And would welcome an opportunity to bring the portfolio committee on all these areas.
All right, from the side of the portfolio committee, I think that the department has done well.
It's not cut and sewn, you cannot verify do that. So, but I think that we have to accept their level of readiness in engaging with the issue concerned. Because, you know, if you don't, the failure to plan is very dangerous. So, can you see there is a plan in the family saving that there is something out of that? And then on the issue of voting, the youth is always mentioned. It is the duty of all the politicians to ensure that they will move their polls on the issue. Because this, the worst effect of this is the use of which is going to be affected. But you know, when did they say after the referendum? After the referendum, they saw the benefits of being part of the EU. When they saw that they could not come and move as soon as they did before. And then it is only then that they realized that the way into that trouble. Yeah. So I think it's the responsibility of the political parties to ensure that the youth remains engaged forever so that it can help to then drive the democracy in our country. So without further ado, I think that we can release the department now and allow for some table to pick up. But if you are interested in it, you can see we are not rejecting you.
No.
Because I think that it can also enrich you because now it comes from outside.
Yes.
Your framework of doing business.
Thank you.
That's why we wanted IGP out so that we are ready. We change the entire environment and make sure that we don't leave anything else. I don't know how Dr. This is Dr. Nkemu. So the IGP, you can tell us, tell us how we're going to present. Because you don't have
Thank you. Oh, it's right. but I will defend it.
Madam, thank you. So you
No, exactly. But I'll send you. It's based on the but I'll send you the summary.
All right,
the committee is now in session. The last presentation from Dr. Mukembe. And then she said that she speaking from his mouth, he'll send the presentation later today to the parliamentary secretary. So I think now we must be very, very attentive. So from him, you are welcome in this CC meeting as one of our stakeholders of the Coastal Community. The work done by the IDT is very appreciated by this committee, because that part makes our democratic vibrant, that we have to listen to all the voices which are out there in the field. Because sometimes we might be preoccupied with our political position and then lose the bigger picture in the process.
Mm-hmm.
So the work of people like you is really welcome. That's why we need that fresh perspective, so that we can reflect on our own, that are we still on the right track or not. Hence, we said that this local decision might consider this application. Because although in the future, if we didn't make something like this, we will not have set you up on the same day. Because it is not making it complete. But today is the issue of the flowing of ideas, so that we can share. That's why I welcome the participation, so that we can also learn something out of you. I think we also have learned something out of them. So that as South African citizens, we take South Africa to the highest city has never achieved before. Because it is the responsibility of each and every South African citizen to ensure that we benefit maximally all the policies that we can do. Where the policies are failing us, we have to reflect and try to change them in an orderly way. So this type of engagement is very critical. I will also welcome the member from the side of the ACP, our outfit. She was engaged somewhere and she's back. In the committee, we really appreciate your commitment. We know that you are overstretched, but then the way you prioritize the committee is very appreciated. So, Dr. Superman, can you introduce yourself?
That's a compliment. Thank you, colleagues. My presentation is based on a research paper that I've done, which is still in draft format, will be finalized until the end of September. But it's evaluating the South Africa-EU strategic partnership. And it's based not just on work done this year, but it's also based on some field work in Europe, in Germany, in France, in at the European Commission, and also in the Netherlands. And so some of that field work also fed into the paper. My title is basically recalibrating the South Africa-EU strategic partnership with a question mark, whether we can still consider it to be strategic where it is today. Basically, the EU, I won't touch on many of the points that have already been presented. I'll brush over those ones. We know that the EU is one of South Africa's most important trade partners. So while China is our most important trade partner as a country, the EU remains our biggest trade partner as a region. And it's quite a unique relationship because it's between a country on the one hand and a legal entity on the other. Some of the members of the European Union supported the anti-apartheid movement. Some of the members of the EU were slow in reacting. So it's quite a unique entity in the sense that it combines all of these different countries, and we engage obviously with them. It was our first, free trade agreement in the post 1994 era. It was between South Africa and the EU, and that was within the framework of the Trade Development and Cooperation Agreement, which we came into in 1999, although in terms of its implementation, it was only fully implemented from 2012, when 90% of goods basically were falling under the free trade agreement. Now, what is interesting here is that while we speak about growing relations with China, for instance, and South-South cooperation, it's often lost. It often creates a misperception that South Africa is either choosing China over the EU, for instance. And I think there's no better way to signify that or to crystallize that by just looking at the amount of FDI that is coming from the EU. 77% of FDI that comes into South Africa is coming from the EU. It's not coming from China. That is a significant issue that we need to look at. 70% of official development assistance into South Africa is coming from the European Union. So the EU plays a strong role in South Africa in terms of trade and in terms of development issues. In terms of development issues, we've seen over recent years a big decline in the amount of funds that are coming into South Africa from the EU. And that is not because the EU targeted South Africa specifically and to reduce those funds, but that's part of a broader policy from the EU towards emerging economies, where it is reducing the amount of official development assistance going into those countries, which then obviously affects South Africa. There were issues around that, because what it does highlight is the ability of the EU to define the terms of the relationship. So, whereas South Africa still faces critical challenges within its society, inequality, poverty, and you name it, while we still face those, our ODA is declining from the EU. But on that point, what it creates, I think, is still opportunities in the area of trilateral cooperation. Now, trilateral cooperation is, for instance, how the OECD often defines it, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, is where a donor country works with an emerging economy in a third country, working to jointly implement development programs in that third country. We have examples of it in South Africa, through our relations with Germany. So Germany had a trilateral cooperation fund, and we worked with Germany in third countries such as Tanzania in boosting it. A lot of it was focused on capacity building in those countries. Trilateral cooperation in that sense present opportunities. When we look at the EU countries, there's not too many which have an actual policy on trilateral cooperation. So when we look at the OECD, for instance, Japan has a policy on trilateral cooperation, Spain has a policy on trilateral cooperation, and Germany also has a policy on trilateral cooperation. The EU doesn't have a policy on trilateral cooperation. And it's been a reluctant player in trilateral cooperation. However, in interviews with members from the EU, it was quite clear that if the EU were to engage and expand its activities within the area of trilateral cooperation, that South Africa fits favorably. And because of how South Africa manages its own reporting, so for instance through the PFMA, it's clear that the EU sees South Africa as a potential partner over there. However, discussions haven't really gone in a sense of formalizing EU-South Africa relations in terms of bilateral cooperation. There's various barriers there. One of them is, yes, the reporting aspect. I mean, the European Commission has to report both to the parliament and to individual member states. So that poses a barrier for the EU in engaging in trilateral activities. But also the funds that are committed to trilateral cooperation are not much. I mean, bilateral cooperation still is the preeminent form of development cooperation. However, what some members from the EU mentioned is that there is definitely in future a possibility for the EU to scale up its activities in that regard. And it would make sense for the EU to engage in trilateral cooperation if the funds being allocated were also much higher than they are currently. Where we've seen issues between South Africa and the EU is that while on the economic side relations are quite strong, even though as an overall percentage you see that South Africa is diversifying its trade partners and therefore the EU is no longer occupying as dominant a role in terms of our overall trade. But nonetheless, relations remain strong in trade and development. But there has been friction in the political aspects of the relationship to an extent that you get a sense from some EU officials that in recent years there was an implicit worry among EU officials that South Africa might be favoring African solidarity and South-South cooperation at the expense of relations with the EU. Now, on the ground, in terms of facts, when you look at the trade and so forth, obviously that is not really the case. But on the political side, we saw those type of agreements coming to the fore, for instance, with the Zimbabwean political crisis. So the EU-South Africa Strategic Partnership comes into play in 2006, 2007. We adopt a joint action plan between South Africa and the EU. 2008, we have elections in Zimbabwe. So literally 1 year after the signing of a joint action plan. And that created some a friction between South Africa and the EU, where the EU felt that South Africa is not upholding its own values, wanted South Africa to adopt something which you may call a megaphone diplomacy towards Zimbabwe. But then South Africa obviously was understood that it had the best way to approach the crisis is through quiet diplomacy. What's interesting there to highlight is not the frictions themselves, but what's interesting to highlight is how that relationship has evolved to late. We see that the EU's position has come much closer to South Africa's position. To an extent that some of the sanctions, for instance, towards Zimbabwe have been actually softened from the EU side. And what's interesting there is to see how South Africa and the EU has used the strategic partnership to come to understand each other much better. So the EU, for instance, whereas in the past it looked at South Africa in terms of we share the common values and so forth, but I think of late it's come to understand some of the complexities that are there in terms of South Africa implementing what it calls its African agenda. That there are certain complexities within the continent that constrain South Africa's behavior, and that means that South Africa, in terms of implementing its foreign policy, often takes a multilateral approach. And rather than working unilaterally, for instance, it works within SADC, it works within the African Union. And of course, if you're working on a multilateral basis, there's many compromises that you have to take. So I think what's interesting there is not so much to highlight the tensions that arose between South Africa and its EU counterparts, but it's shown, I think, the importance of a strategic partnership in actually ironing out some of the tensions that obviously will come in global politics. You will never agree on all issues, but I think what the strategic partnership allows, at least, is a platform where you have political dialogue at quite a high level to ensure that the EU can understand South Africa's constraints, but that also South Africa can understand some of the EU's positions. So that's sort of an interesting area in that sense. When it comes to enhancing the African agenda, there's some opportunities here in this strategic partnership, especially in the area of peace and security. South Africa prioritizes peace and security within Africa. And it's clear that because of the strong role that the EU plays in Africa as a development partner, it's clear that South Africa has to work with the EU in implementing its own African agenda on the continent. A key area there, for instance, is funding. You look at just the AU Commission itself, its own budget, something like close to 80% of the budget of the AU Commission, you know, was for the operational efforts, was actually coming from the European Union. If you look at the African peace and security architecture, which is quite an important aim, I think, also within South Africa's foreign policy, in ensuring that Africa is able to take care of its own issues when it comes to peace and security. And if you look at all of those issues, a lot of funds for that architecture is actually coming from the European Union. So in that sense, the EU plays an important role in filling the funding gap that's coming towards pan-African institutions. You just have to see the recent budget of the African Union. It was sitting around $460 million US dollars. Of that, African countries had contributed around $150-160 million. The rest came from donors. And that really shows that while in terms of South African foreign policy and what it calls the African agenda, while it wants Africa to be self-sufficient, while it wants these institutions to be self-funded, in order to get there, the reality is that South Africa has to work with its donors, in at least with African donors, such as the EU, in ensuring that these institutions are funded. And one of the issues, obviously, that South Africa has been working within the UN is closer cooperation between the United Nations and the African Union. So the EU will continue to play an important role in terms of South Africa's foreign policy within Africa, because it's clear that while South Africa may have aims within the continent, it's clear that it does not have the capacity to finance all of its aims on the continent. And in order to fill the funding gap, the EU definitely plays an important role. And one of the ways that you will play, again, is going back to what I said earlier, is through trilateral cooperation. Because I think when SETSA, for instance, does become operational, one of the important things to notice is that South Africa will not be able, again, to be everywhere on the continent. I think if it could, it would, but it won't have that financial ability to be able to do that. And one of the ways that it can use its relationship with the EU is through trilateral cooperation, working on joint projects in Africa, utilizing some of the funding that's coming from the European Union. And then, of course, looking ahead, I think, looking at some of the more strategic areas in the partnership, I think what's important is to not reduce the partnership to purely to regional issues. The partnership has to still maintain its strategic level on global issues. So we spoke earlier, for instance, about the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. And that one, despite the fact that Brexit, growing discontent within Europe, has actually, you know, put a spanner in the works and meant that the TTIP will probably not, it will not succeed. I think they are important lessons for South Africa's foreign policy. South Africa's foreign policy focuses a lot on multilateralism as an important issue. That means that in trade issues, the WTO is important in terms of South Africa's foreign policy. But what we noticed from the TISA negotiations is that there's an increasing willingness from the EU and the United States to actually circumvent the WTO and try to forge mega regional trade agreements. I mean, if TISA has had to pass as it is, it would essentially have meant, especially it would have negative impacts on third countries, despite what the EU said through a commission study. Further studies have shown that it would have had a negative impact on Africa, it would have had a negative impact on South Africa, the ability to access the EU market, access the United States market. But what it would have also meant is that any subsequent trade agreements that we would have had to make with the EU or with the United States would have actually been subjected to some of the terms and conditions that have been agreed between the EU and the US. So essentially the EU and the US would have been rewriting global trade rules and ensuring that certain rules which would have not come into place through the WTO would have actually, you know, come via the back door. So what this means, I think, in terms of moving forward is that we need to, as South Africa, continue to engage the EU on bringing the WTO back to the center of global trade and addressing some of the shortfalls, of course, of the WTO. But we certainly need to keep in mind that we need to use this partnership to also voice our own displeasure at some of the agreements that the EU was ready to basically sign with the United States, despite the fact that they have failed, because it does show that there's a willingness to actually go outside of the WTO, which would negatively impact, I think, many countries. I think some of these issues, you know, we can continue to elaborate on, but I think those are the key points, I think, that I just wanted to highlight in this presentation. The importance of the EU in terms of as a development partner, but also as a trade partner, through the importance of the EU in terms of meeting South Africa's own goals within the continent. So the EU as a funder, for instance, to the African Union and other than African institutions. The potential role of trilateral cooperation, which is something that South Africa, I think, when compared to other emerging economies, South Africa is relatively open to the possibility of trilateral cooperation. So I think that is an area that we can certainly engage the EU on. And then lastly, to actually look at the reality that the EU and the US are willing to go outside of the WTO, and therefore if they go outside, it weakens the WTO, and it also potentially weakens South Africa's standing when it comes to global trade. So those are some of the issues that I wish to point out to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kamshin, for the presentation. I think that it has brought a fresh aspect to the issue you had this morning. Just like the issue of trilateral cooperation, our shortcomings as a country, when it comes to our own problems in the continent, I think that even this presentation will make that even ourselves to recalculate the way we're going to complete our position outside there. That's why, you know, whenever you go to the EU, this issue of South Africa has been no choice. It's always been raised. It's of China, so it's always been raised. Yeah. So it will be critical that when we meet with our EU partners, from when they come here, we must really engage them positively and appreciate the good work which they are doing. Well, I know that when we're doing trade negotiations, they put a lot, they subsidize their farmers, they did all those things. But when we look at the balance of evidence, we find that there are also good things which are doing for us and the good things. I think this is going to be a good preparation for us, but it is not only to say that, or to comment, yes, the presentation from Dr. Ndengu, it's going to send the slides which you information which you were done last year, but also what is very good is that it is still research on the sample of EU countries about all the issues we are speaking about. I think that one is very important. It's not a laptop search,
More and more. Dr. Tim, thank you very much for the presentation. Always I would be disappointed in the occasion. And then I think, Chair, just to compare with in terms of the field research that was conducted, give a fresh perspective on the same. And clearly, definitely, it shows the significance of the EU. As far as South Africa and Africa in general is concerned. I just want your opinion as far as the AU budget is concerned. The former president of Nigeria was tasked by the AU to come up with a new funding model for the AU. What is your view on that in light of almost $300 million of the EU budget coming from donors, and while the significant amount definitely comes from the EU in particular, what does it mean, the result of that study of Asanjo, by probably the practical reality of what we have at the moment? The second one is the collapse of the chief. I was in Geneva last around October, when the U.S. Chamber of Business, together with the European counterparts, were trying to negotiate the deal, and the amount of protectionism and conservatism that I witnessed there was quite alarming. And I think I have to agree that the best way possible way is to bring back the impact of the World Trade Organization. But how will the collapse of TIP impact on the grand political economy of the world in light of the rise of protectionism and rise of conservatism, rise of key to the opening of markets in Africa, because of the Europeans and Americans want us to open the market while they would want to opt for protectionism and closing their market? What does it mean in the bigger scheme of things?
Thank you. Is there anything?
Thank you. Partly because I'm sorry, the first presentation, I'm not even sure who presented. What was your taking in terms of the way forward for South Africa relating to the Brexit thing in the UK? Will there be pressure from the EU in terms of how we go forward in that relationship? Will there be any constraints? Should there be any constraints? Is there things we should be looking out for, pitfalls, those kind of things? And linking to the planning scan, the way forward for South Africa in the last presentation.
Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Jackie, for that input. She was my partner in crime when we planned to help every day.
We may have to. Really,
I think that those guys are concerned, but as much as they are concerned about our business, but they are also committed to us in succeeding any country.
Yeah.
Because South Africa becomes this kind of democracy. So I think that they want that as a feather on their caps that they did help South Africa emerge from apartheid and it became stronger. So they are really interested in us succeeding any country. It's up to us now to manage those relationships. Yeah. But really, I think this input is very high level. In particular, when they are like when it comes with the issue of the WTO, really this issue of multilateralism, which the United States went for, because they consider with the dollar type of negotiation from there, they have to open up their market in the US. Hence, they came with a unilateral decision of Agoa. But no, if you go Agoa, it becomes a favor to us. Whereas if it's one for us to be protected, it must be a formal structure so that the rule can be because if it is unilateral, you know, this thing can be resolved. The law can be restored at any time. This day, now, we saw the position then. But I think that they also remain our important partner. You can respond to this. Three questions
to raise, Dr. Thank you. I think on the EU budget, on the AU budget, and the shortfalls of funding, there were some proposals by the committee that former President Obasanjo shared, and some of those involved, you know, a special tax on, I think it was on tourists who are coming into Africa. I'm not sure of the exact percentage of the tax, but this was proposed as an option towards funding the AU budget. I think with that, as with all proposals, you know, the key there is firstly whether it's binding, and then second whether, because these are proposals, they would have to be implemented at the national level. So there's already countries who are saying, hey, if we take these recommendations on, we will hurt our tourism sector. But it really points, I think, to the difficulties in terms of this idea of building more coherency and independence within the continent, especially through the Pan-African institutions. Funding is going to be very important. But I think what is encouraging is that since last year, already with the Financing for Development meeting, which took place in Addis Ababa, there seems to be a resurgence in the idea of mobilizing resources from within the continent, because it's quite clear that, you know, that that Europe is in an uncertain stage, and it's quite clear that if you're going to be dependent on funding coming from outside, I think you are shooting yourself in the foot. I mean, this goes first, these recommendations, they also go with recommendations related to illicit flows on the continent. The idea we often have in Africa is that we are recipients of money coming from abroad, that we are recipients of aid and so on and so forth. But if you just look at just the amount that the African diaspora puts back within the continent, that alone is more than the amount of foreign aid actually coming into Africa. It's also a reality that more money leaving the continent than is actually coming into the continent through some of these illicit flows. And so I think what it means, and it also points to the role that South Africa plays within Africa, it's important, I think, that, you know, if there's a contribution that South Africa makes, it's in really entrenching the idea of taking responsibility for the problems that we have, you know, on the continent, without obviously putting the donors off the hook. So it's clear that donors have to continually be put under pressure to meet their obligations. And we heard earlier that the UK has actually been one of the, you know, the UK is one of the countries which has actually met its 0.7% obligation. But other donors are obviously not meeting that. On the one hand, we do need to put pressure on them. But on the other hand, I think it puts pressure on policy makers, but also on civil society organizations to say, how can we come up with more creative ways to finance these institutions? Ethiopia provided an example through its Renaissance Dam project. Nobody wanted to fund it. They had applied to the World Bank, they had applied to various institutions to actually fund the Renaissance Dam project. And they simply couldn't get the money. What they did is they ended up mobilizing Ethiopian society and the Ethiopian diaspora to actually contribute. That, with that, there was also contribution from China to that. So the Ethiopians, I think, showed that if you're innovative, you can come up with alternative ways to actually fund your own development. And I think that's going to be the challenge moving forward for South Africa's foreign policy in Africa, but also for African countries in realizing, for instance, Agenda 2063. An important issue will be whether we can finance our own funding. And yes, the Obakanjo Committee makes, you know, certain recommendations, but again, whether these can be implemented is another issue. On the collapse of thesis, rise of protectionism, it's very true that for many years, developing countries were told, open up your markets, that free trade is basically, you know, the way to go and so forth. And some emerging economies have actually shown benefits. They've shown that they've gained. You know, so for instance, South Africa is quite an open economy, one of the most open economies out there. But we've seen in recent years, as developing countries became stronger and more confident within the framework of the WTO, and in putting development issues at the core of also trade issues, we've seen that unfortunately, that the EU and the US have actually moved backwards in terms of using the WTO. Mm. And you must remember that before the Doha round, negotiations for the developed world were much more simpler. You could argue it was easier. They were simply reducing trade barriers among themselves. They could also impose their will much easier to other countries. But the Doha round, I think, changed a lot of dynamics and crystallized the idea of rising powers or at least of an ushering in of a multipolar world order. And that obviously complicates things when it comes to negotiations for them. What we need to be pushing them on is that they shouldn't now go and do these unilateral or bilateral deals among themselves to actually keep emerging economies in the developing world out. So TTIP is just one, but there's also the trade in services agreement, and there's also the Trans-Pacific partnership. None of those agreements have any of the BRICS countries there. It's literally redrawing the global trade geography and rewriting the rules. So it's not just about trade. There's a geopolitical aspect here, and this is what we need to be aware of. And it's something that we need to, I think, raise with our partners, because if we're strategic partners and if we speak on the same level, then it's something that we should be confident enough to raise with them. I mean, I think if South Africa were to sign, some agreements that were not involving the EU, but which would impact the EU, I don't think the EU would shy away, from raising those issues and saying that we do have concerns about this. We understand that you have your own sovereignty and that you have the legitimacy to take whatever decisions you take, but we want to register our discomfort with the direction that you're taking. I think we can raise those issues. And in fact, I think what we have to be also aware of is that within Europe, there are many voices which actually see the TTIP as we see it. So it's important to not look at the EU as a single unitary actor. Mm. It's very important because we have organizations in Europe who actually see the heaters in the way we see it. So give one quick example. In Germany, which is a very important player in terms of these negotiations and in Europe, initially when the first pronouncement on heaters came out, the EU had commissioned a study. The EU had commissioned a study, and they basically said that it will have massive gains for everyone. Everyone will be better off. They even pointed out certain figures there. However, when European civil society and think tanks in Europe started to think more about this agreement and not simply accept what the then Trade Commissioner de Gucht, what he was saying, when they started to look deeper into this, they started to find a lot of loopholes in this agreement. They started to realize that it would mean that multinational corporations, through the investor-state dispute settlement mechanism, would actually have the power to sue sovereign governments for implementing policies which would have a detrimental effect on their profit, although they would have a positive impact on society. Now, this is a major issue here, because it means that a multinational corporation can go outside of your court, and this investor state dispute mechanism, it's literally private corporate lawyers who sit somewhere in Geneva or anywhere, who have a kind of a revolving door policy. So they work for big multinational corporations, but at the same time, they are sitting there and judging these court cases. This is a major issue. I mean, just one example in Germany. So Vattenfall, which is a Swedish energy company, I think, when the German government decided that it doesn't want to continue with using nuclear energy in Germany, they were sued by Vattenfall. And despite the fact that, and if Germany can be sued, now you can imagine what can happen in other countries if Germany can actually be sued by multinational corporations. So these are issues that we obviously have to take into account, because this agreement wouldn't have been involved us, but in the future it would have certainly involved us, because some of the rules agreed to then would have had an impact on us. And that's why, you know, we see all the time, for instance, us in the think tank environment, you get a foreign visitor coming into South Africa, maybe someone from Europe who's handling trade issues, and they will come and they will hold meetings with civil society organizations, because they want to hear what people are thinking on these issues. They will get experts to come and make certain presentations. And of course that helps them, because they are gathering. They're doing their own research, right? So I think it's important that even us, when we go to Europe and to the US and so forth, on an official level, it's important to slowly, to identify the different voices that are there within these countries, and to meet them. So to meet people who, not only to meet those who agree with us, obviously, but also to meet and have a real idea of what the landscape is. Because I think that also has a positive impact when we have official talks with the EU, or when we have official talks with the US, because then we know what's happening in their own society, and if an official delegation says, no, but our people are actually supporting this, then you can say, no, actually, but then there's these organizations which are actually lobbying against you, environmental groups, consumer rights groups, and so forth. They were all opposed to teachers, students, and so forth. So it's important, that for us, when we engage with them, I think at an official level, to have already gotten the input from their own citizens, which we can, if we choose to or not, use in the official talk. But I think it's important to get an idea of the overall landscape. And then a last point, I guess, the way forward in terms of Brexit, you know, maybe one positive is that it actually maybe been the last nail in the coffin for the Tories. You know, that may be a positive thing for us, because the British were one of the, you know, real supporters of TTIP, and they really supported TTIP. I think with them, they're not gone, but the uncertainty that it created certainly means that's a final nail in the coffin. And I think that has a positive impact, at least for other countries not involved in the negotiations. But also I've seen a report which says that there might be that a lot of the fruit and veggies which British supermarkets are actually sourcing from Europe are coming from Spain and are coming from the Netherlands. And that if, because of this uncertainty, it may mean that UK supermarkets have to source their fruits and veggies from outside the EU. And that creates opportunities for African farmers, I think, because we've been actually excluded from, I mean, there's been a lot of technical things which have been used against African farmers, so phyto and sanitary measures and so forth. And it's really petty things, but technical things which are used to prevent our products from accessing the EU. And what might be interesting is to see then whether the Brexit will have, you know, an impact on our products, you know, being able to actually, at least more product being able to access the UK. And it might also put pressure. I think whatever negotiations we have to enter into with the EU, I think we already see that there's problems in the EU. So the EU is under pressure to show that they're resolving their problems, to show that, you know, that nothing will change and so forth. But I think this creates opportunities for us to get guarantees and to say, are we sure that, you know, nothing is actually going to change? I mean, we find now this EPA, but of course a lot, you know, 20% or so of our goods into the EU are going to the UK. So I think we need to be constantly, as the minister said, we need to constantly be looking for opportunities and understanding that certain things we cannot control, but we need to understand what it is that we can control and use when we negotiate with the British, who will need to maintain relations with us. So it's not that I think there's like 5,000, you know, agreements, but I think we're not too low down their radar. So I think they are interested in what we have to say, and I think we can certainly engage them. And and I think that was it. And you also mentioned AGOA, but also again, they just about the importance that we're looking for. AGOA, you know, it won't be sustainable if it's just unilateral thing from the United States, but if there's actually a reciprocal agreement between us and them, but maybe not even bilaterally, but also actually concluding the Doha round. And I think a lot of that, in terms of bringing the WTO back into the fore, will also mean going back into the idea of reform within the WTO and making it easier for trade delegation, I think, to trade within the WTO. But I think those are certainly issues we can raise with the EU, because these are countries, remember, that who have always proclaimed themselves to be open, to support free trade, and I think this is then a chance for us to use that against them and to say, well, guys, you're always saying that you're open to trade, you know, put pressure on them on the common agriculture policy and other measures where we see clear signs of protectionism. I think we need to push these countries to not say they are open when it suits them and then they close when it actually suits them. Because despite the fact that they have protection measures, they are still, when they give development cooperation, they still tell their recipients to open their markets and so forth. So it's important for, especially for South Africa, who is not dependent on aid. So I think it's less than 1% of our budget where we actually get development cooperation. So we're not dependent on it, although it does help communities where it goes to. It's important for us to raise, you know, those issues and pressure, because we're not like countries which are aid dependent, which may not be able to raise some of those issues. Yeah.
I think this important honorable members, I think that has prepared us thoroughly to go and engage with our big partners, even the social market. As we see that we cannot be hostile, we can see that we still need them, but we must be affected. We must be affected. There are certain things we have that we must demand, and then we must lead them, and then there are certain things which we must be humble for what they've done. Because when you look at it, as one of the doctors says, more than that million US dollars coming to Africa from the donors, and then the big donors are the EU, then you can see that for the zero we so, but only way of taking Africa out of the quagmire on Galapa is to ensure that the African economy is functional. We have to grow the African economy. We have to grow the trade within Africa. Because that's the only way. But when they are self-sufficient, it's only then that they are not going to become a perfect human. So I think that the talk has given us the point that what we should do, and how we can cook each other. Very short something we still high application. I think that even when the paper is finished, it's very appreciated if we can launch it officially. Launch it officially, invite us so that we can go and engage with us with business, because we do need that information. But just remember, is there anything which was changed out of this presentation? It's like that, members. I think that now we're coming to the end of the meeting. I don't know whether there are any announcements on the side of the Star of the City. to play a good part. If the world under the bridge part for the future, I think they are important to done for part. Remember, the child is waiting with time, they plan, prepare, they plan to pray for us, and then I think what?
Now, Chair, you recall at our last meeting, members raised the issue of the dialogue with the I put together a document too. Sorry that it's at this point, which I with your permission, can be distributed to other members.
Alright, thank you for the GM. I really appreciate your input this morning and still now in the afternoon. And then we're able to speak the problem on time so we can go into our work and make that up. Thank you.
Thank you.
I
haven't been working out.
Yeah, absolutely.